Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week.
Hi everybody, and welcome to the LSAT Demon Daily Podcast. My name is Eric Johansson. I am a teacher and tutor with the LSAT Demon, and with me today is now former LSAT Demon student, Megan Ezekanaga, who just submitted her applications, having crushed the LSAT. How are you doing today, Megan?
I'm doing great. All my applications are in, so I'm just happy.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on reaching the end of your LSAT journey. Give me a brief overview of just the scope of where you started, where you ended up, and how long you were studying.
So it was last fall. My husband and I we're both in the Army, so we've been talking about getting out. We weren't sure when to do it. And last fall, he decided he's 100% going to go to MBA. And we thought we were going to go this fall. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I started thinking about my options and decided, he mentioned I should go to law school. And after 2 weeks of thinking about it, decided, yes, this is what I'm going to do. So that was September last year. And I thought I could just take the LSAT, apply in a couple months, and I'd be good to go. I did not know what I was getting into. So September 2021 is when I started studying. I just did a quick Google search of how do you study for the LSAT, and I found some free, this is a recommended 3-month study guide from some free website. I bought every single test, paper test from Amazon, and a couple different hardback books, some paper books, and started studying. And I said, you know, I'm going to be all in on this. So I searched for podcasts that had the word LSAT or law school. And so I found the LSAT Demon and I started listening to Ben and Nathan. And I realized there's a much better way than just reading all these questions randomly and not really having a sort of path or any sort of structure, I suppose. So my first practice test I took before I found about LSAT Demon, I did it on paper. I got a 154. I think at most I just kind of reviewed what each section was about. And I took it sitting outside at a coffee shop, but like writing down the answers. Like I left the house because I have a daughter. So like I gotta get out of the house. The dog and my daughter are gonna be distracting, and took it outside of the coffee shop. But once I found LSAT Demon though, I was like, those books have been collecting dust in my office because using the online program, I didn't even know the LSAT was online. That's how little I knew about what it was. Sure. But the website is just so intuitive and easy, and you can review everything. So I love that about LSAT Demon. So I actually wrote in to Nathan and Ben probably November last year asking like, hey, is it crazy for me to take the test in January and apply for law school? And they basically said, yeah, it's kind of like you're rushing it. I do have the full GI Bill, so I'm very lucky. So I'm just applying to get in, and I already have law school paid for, which I know is one of the LSAT Demon philosophies. So I was very, very fortunate to have that. But based off their advice, and my husband and I thought a little bit more, we decided to wait a year. And that was the best decision because I got a 162 in January. And I knew that I had a lot more to go. I could do better. I wasn't perfect on games yet. And I kind of just was winging it a little bit at that point. So decided to keep studying and keep going on and apply this fall.
Yeah. Talk about that decision, because I went through a similar one myself last year. I thought I was similarly going to apply late in the cycle last year to attend school starting in 2022. And that is not the case. But I remember it being a difficult coming to terms moment. Yeah. Was it the same for you, especially with family involved?
Oh, yes. Once I decide how something in my life is going to happen, it has to happen that way. And I was very much like, I love the Army. Don't get me wrong. It's given me a lot, but I now have 2 children. I'm married and we want to stay in one place. And the longer you stay in the Army, the more you move. And so once I decided, I started telling everybody, so I'm like, I'm getting out of the Army and like, it's going to happen. So then to have to backtrack that and say, actually 1 more year, I'll stay in 1 more year. It definitely was humbling, but the right decision, because, you know, we're going to go back to school, not have our source of income. So we're saving aggressively right now. So that was good. And also, I think I would have been rushed if I would have tried to do that. And I have a 6-month-old as well. So I'd have had an infant in law school, and that wouldn't have mixed. So it's good. I think it was the right decision. And oftentimes, yeah, I'm 31, so I'm even older, and I'm still feeling like I hear a lot of these, you know, college students think, oh, I'm going to be too old if I wait a year. I don't really have that perspective, but I did feel that pressure a little bit. But now that I waited, it doesn't feel like I lost any time at all.
Right. Okay. Well, you probably finished, you talk more about your journey later, but you probably finished, got the LSAT, and then immediately it was time to start on other aspects of your application. So it was, but you got to do those things, hopefully not simultaneously.
Yeah.
So you got the 162, in January. You had decided, I'm going to keep studying. I know I can do better. Where did you go from there?
Well, I thought that I would be able to study a lot still between January to March, which was the plan, but my job got really busy. I was pregnant with my second child at that time, who was due in April. So I thought, I'm going to swim out another LSAT right before she's born. I ended up canceling. I registered for that test. I canceled it because I didn't study enough because work got crazy. And I was just kind of like 1 hour a day at least. And I think I was on the free plan for a while. Once my daughter was born in April, though, took a couple weeks off, you know, to be a mom. And then being on maternity leave, she naps all the time. Infants, if anybody's familiar with infants, they just eat and sleep all the time. So that was awesome. I was able to study a lot. And I took the live, that's when I switched to live, is in May. So May and June, I did live. So I was able to go to classes during the day and really was able to spend more time going to classes, studying, and not be distracted by work. So that was great. And I think I scheduled for August after that. Yeah. So I went back to work right after I took the test. So I took extra time off, took the August test. And
so that you could keep studying until before you went back to work. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that way, like, go back to work, I can get back in work zone and not worry about the LSAT. But I was scoring it like the high 160s to low 170s. So when I got a 165 in August, I was like, okay, I can do better. I know I can do better. And I'd already put all this time and I'd gone to all these classes. So really though, between August and October, I took like 4 or 5 tests, but I did a lot more sections. And it kind of reviewed things and just stayed fresh. But I think it was more of a confidence thing. I didn't get games perfect, I know, in August, but then October, I know I got games perfect. I think that's what really got me to the 170 is
you knew that you crushed it. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had 10 minutes left. 10 minutes left in the game. I was like, what?
What did you do with your 10 minutes?
Well, there was the questions about if this rule changed to this rule, which rule would keep it the same?
Sure.
I was able to go back and thoroughly make sure I got the right answer. So I spent 10 minutes on this one question. That was great.
Sure. But you crushed it. And so that was the October test?
Yes. Yes.
And you got and you scored a
170.
Nice. So from a diagnostic of 154 over about a year of studying with full-time work in the Army and having an actual child, plus another one that you were caring for at the same time, 16-point improvement, and you're just in a completely different league.
Oh, yeah. It's a game changer. And I feel more confident about my applications and my chances and where I can go. I will say, even though there were periods within that year where I didn't study as much, I was doing an hour a day at least, and getting as much practice as I could, but even when it was like heavy work was really intense. And then the times that I had more time, I would spend more time if I needed to, but I did notice like probably the first 6 months was a lot more time. And then towards the end, like you're leaner, you don't have to spend as much time, but you benefit just as much towards the end.
Yeah. What I love what you said, because you took the August test and you scored at the the bottom end of your range, mm-hmm. but it sounds like you didn't freak out and you didn't overreact. You just knew that you had a bad day for yourself, but that you were still perfectly capable of scoring in the 170s. Mm-hmm. So you didn't overreact. You just stuck to the game plan and kind of trusted in the fact that you were already good at the test and sort of mm-hmm. maintained that until you got to October and then had all the confidence in the world going into that test.
Yeah.
Awesome. So that's great. Tell me about that a little bit more about that routine. Did you find, given how busy you were at various points and having kids and kind of your schedule changing, that you were able to at least, you said you always kept at least 1 hour per day. Yeah. Was that, mm-hmm. Did you like carve out an hour a day that you always knew was your study time, or did it kind of fluctuate?
Yeah.
To what extent were you like strict with when and how you studied versus just kind of changed accordingly?
I wish I was stricter with myself. I think it would have been, maybe I would have been a little shorter time frame for me, but sometimes I'd get the hour after my kids went to daycare, my husband would take them early. Most times it was during lunch. That was the best time for me because I was at work, so I could close the door or go off somewhere and study for an hour at lunch. That was the best time. But when I was studying more than 1 hour a day, it was after bedtime routine. So I'd do the bath, put both the girls to bed, and then I'd get an hour or two. And before my other daughter was born, put her to bed. But that was good too. My husband's studying for the GRE at the same time, so it's not like we wanted to hang out at night. We both were studying. He got the office. I got the kitchen.
Gotcha.
So that helped having a study buddy, someone suffering through it. We didn't get to compare questions, but we at least knew we were both busy and we're not pressuring each other to like go out to dinner or something.
Yeah, you were both thick of it and commiserating.
We're both playing and studying. Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Cool. Were there any points along the way that you reflect on as like inflection points when something really clicked, or I don't know, maybe it was just the decision to delay, or like key moments on the journey that stick out in your mind where you kind of realized that something about the test that kind of took you to the next level?
Yeah, probably three different moments. The first thing, the decision to wait a year and realizing that I can take my time and get really good at this. And I don't remember who mentioned it, but comparing the test to a marathon, not a sprint, and training, or even just training like any sort of athletic competition, that it takes time. Your brain is a muscle. So that was an epiphany. Like I can't spend 5 or 6 hours every day on this. Like I just like, I don't go out and run 10 miles right now. Like I'm running only 15 minutes to get better at running.
Sure.
And then the other two is the live classes. I was decent at reading comprehension before, but it was also the thing I hated studying the most, cause I just didn't want to do it. Doing the live classes and forcing myself to go to the reading classes was super, super beneficial. And volunteering to answer questions or read and learning how to read through it and like anticipate questions. So that really helped, I think, get me a couple more questions better on reading comprehension. And then finally, understanding how to do worlds in the games was huge. And understanding the entire game before I started writing anything down. Cause I was notorious. Like I would write, and then get to the end and like, I misunderstood it. So mm-hmm. once I started just reading the whole thing and then building the world, if it was worlds, I did much better. So those three things.
That's something I try to model and talk about in my classes a lot, is read through the whole game and try to understand it in your own brain first. Mm-hmm. And recognize that you can understand a lot of it before having to write anything down. And mm-hmm. to the extent that you can, it's going to keep you from writing down stuff that's wrong. So that's great.
Every time I mess up, it's because I started writing. My August test, I missed a rule because I misread it. And so I wasted mm-hmm. so much time.
Yeah.
So makes a big difference.
So you said that the going to the live classes was a big help. Was that just like the extra motivation of having that resource?
Yeah, it was a forcing function. I made sure 3 to 4 times a week to go to a class that included reading, or if it was completely on reading comprehension. That was like games. I could do games all night long. Like I probably will still do it. No, I run probably won't, but like, I love doing, I would sit here with a glass of wine and like do games and I'd be like, wow, it's already 10 o'clock. Oh my goodness. But reading comprehension was hard. So the live classes was a great motivating factor for me to get better at reading comprehension.
Did you ever get to a point where it felt like you had a little bit of that games experience on reading comp?
It did. At the very end, it did. It did. I started, that's between the August and October test. If I did a section, it was reading, and I'd be done. I'm like, wow, I got this. It's kind of like you get that swagger because you're like, wow, I didn't miss any. Oh my goodness.
I also love on reading comp, you can actually learn things. Like I have learned things from LSAT reading comp.
Yeah, teaching yourself or figuring out how to get yourself interested was a big, once you do that, once you're like, wait, I do want to learn about, you know, journalism in the, I don't know, 1800s, whatever, random thing that they bring up. And you're like, I didn't even know this was a thing, but it is. So totally. I'm going to figure it out and I can tell a story at a party about this. Like,
awesome. Cool. Well, Megan, big congratulations on all that you've accomplished and best of luck. Definitely stay in touch with the outcome of your applications. How many schools have you applied to?
16 schools.
16 schools. Mm-hmm. And was that a casting a wide net geographically? Is your family okay with the move? Or are you trying to stay put?
We ideally want to end up in Texas. We love Texas, but we're pretty much all over the place. Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, all over the place.
Great.
My husband's going to get his MBA too. So we're just trying to match same city or same school. Sure. So out of the 16, I'm sure we'll both get into at least one.
Awesome. Well, that's so great. Any final parting words of wisdom or advice for those students listening right now who are on their own grinds?
Yes, I think there's three things that I think help me. One is mastering the games, getting none wrong, getting them all right, reading comprehension, engaging the passage, and stating the main point in your own words will help set you off on the right foot. And then finally, one question at a time. It's just one question at a time. Don't go beyond that. I had a child while studying, so I had the same mantra. One contraction at a time. So this can apply to multiple areas of your life. And now I'm getting back into running. So it's 1 mile at a time, 1 minute at a time, whatever.
Heck, so you one can apply step at it. A time.
Yeah. Amen to that.
I'm running a little bit myself lately as well. And it's a lot of just like, all right, get to that tree.
Yes.
And then once you're done with that tree, take a breath. Okay, get to that mailbox.
Oh, yeah.
Great. All right. So that was get perfect on the games, really engage and become interested in the RC passages, and take everything one question at a time. Love it. Yeah. Megan Ezekanaga is a former LSAT Demon student who went from a 154 to a 170 and now has applications in. Congratulations again, Megan, and thanks for joining, and stay in touch.
Thanks for having me.
Hey there. Welcome to the LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Matt Dumont, an LSAT teacher and tutor at the LSAT Demon and 3L at the University of Maryland. Represent. With me is Becca Cumberbatch, who also teaches and tutors at the Demon and is also a 3L at the University of Maryland. How are you, Becca?
So great. So glad to be here. Really feeling like I missed out on the opportunity for some product placement because I am just wearing a green shirt.
Yes.
So I'm here to support the color green.
I am here to support both the University of Maryland and the Demon with my shirt and hat. I'm repping everything at the same time.
So on brand. That's great.
How does it feel to almost be in your last semester of law school?
Great. I have to say, I wonder if you've had this thought, Matt, of all of my many schools and educational experiences, this is the one that I have most thoroughly not hated. And as someone who famously had a bad attitude in school, this has been my favorite one.
I can only compare this to theater school because that's the only other schooling, formal, like post high school education. And I'm not sure law school is quite as fun as acting school. But I have also thoroughly not hated law school. What a way to put it. Oh, my God. Well, I hope that your Thanksgiving is going to be great and holiday plans and all that fun stuff. But we're here today to discuss an email from a listener. So without further ado,
finally,
we have an email from Marisol. And Marisol says, "Hi, Demon Help. I am a former LSAT Demon student. I'm currently in law school and about to start applying for internships. I want to get a paid internship in the summer, but there are not many paid internship opportunities. If I did not do an internship during my 1L summer and worked either as a legal assistant or another job, would it look bad that I did not intern in my first year? I would only take an unpaid internship if it was the law firm I really wanted to work for long term. Best, Marisol." So, Miss Becca, what do you think about that?
Well, I have a few thoughts. My first thought is, when you say at the beginning of the question, she says that there aren't many paid internship opportunities. My immediate reaction when I hear that is, yes, there are. Possibly you're, I mean, maybe you're in a geographic area where that's true. If you're really out in the middle of nowhere with no ability to travel or something, I guess.
Right.
But like we're in Baltimore. It's not that big of a city. And yes, Baltimore is by other cities. I get that.
There's tons in Baltimore, though. Yeah.
And just paid. I'm just saying paid options. Yeah. And then there's a quadrillion unpaid things. So my first thing before you even start this would be, how hard did you try? Who did you ask? Did you go to your career development office? Did you actually Google it? Did somebody at lunch say that there aren't many? And then you just took that as a fact? Because if that is the case, then that needs to be the last time you ever do that, you know? Yeah. So already I disagree.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of want to add to that in that you might have geographical restrictions based on where you live, those kind of things, but you don't have to stay where you're going to school during your summer. Like that's kind of the point. In fact, a lot of people travel all over the country for a variety of different things. And so if, for instance, you are in a place that's out in the middle of nowhere, and I can think of quite a few schools that are like that. Washington and Lee is a great example of a great school that's in the middle of nowhere. It is an hour and a half from anything substantive other than that tiny little town that has like 1,000 people in it. And so I can understand where that might be difficult to find a lot of jobs. But I encourage you to think outside of exactly where you live for your summer. Go somewhere else. Explore another legal community. Make connections. If you're in Lexington, like Washington and Lee, go to the state capitol in Richmond. Go to Charlottesville, those kind of places for the summer. And if you're getting paid, you can rent potentially an apartment or find an easy sublet or whatever it is. I strongly want to encourage to think outside your limited geographical area.
Also, it's 2022. Don't tell me you can't find something virtual if you need
that.
Being in person has a lot of pros for things. So that's like the voice of wisdom, maybe. And Matt, you and I have both lovingly referred to ourselves as the olds. Because we are not, we didn't start law school right out of undergrad.
My new favorite is one of our fellow classmates has referred to herself as an elder statesman. And so I have adopted that for myself. I am the younger older statesman in my class with her, but I'm still an older statesman for sure.
I really like that. I will be doing that and I will be pretending that I'm the one who came up with that. Which is interesting, given that my next class after we're done here is intellectual property law survey. So,
yay.
But yeah, so there's that. Then the second question is kind of just saying, like, if I do something else, I don't know what a legal assistant is. I'm willing to say that. I am going to go ahead and put that out there, Matt. What is a legal assistant? Is that a paralegal? You have to have a paralegal
Yeah, I'm assuming it's something of that nature where it might be, you know, like filing papers at a law office, like working in the file room, doing those kind of things. There are certainly legal assistants who do legal research, but it tends to be pretty limited. But it depends. I mean, judicial assistants, if that's what you're talking about, they do a ton because they're not only running the chambers, but they're doing this kind of stuff. But I'm assuming that is not what Marisol is talking about, because she's insinuating, I think, that it's like outside of like this summer internship that would be law school track related.
Right. Yeah, I get that vibe too. Here's what's going to happen. If you do something that is not basically like law clerk or internship is usually what they're called, those kinds of positions. The vast majority of your competition will have done that. And so you're going to be putting on your resume and sitting down in interviews and so on when you're trying to find jobs and then trying to find something after your 2L year and so on and so on. And other people are going to say, oh, for instance, Matt and I can both share what we did after our 1L year. For me, after my 1L year, I was able to say, oh, I had this great internship with Maryland Legal Aid. And I went to the office and I worked on expungement for people's criminal records. And I helped facilitate their lawyer in the library clinic events. And I did intakes and So all this real substantive legal work. Oh, I researched whether we can try to find clients who were evicted based on bad convictions from the Gun Trace Task Force here in Baltimore, like real shit. And that is available to you. I refuse to believe you can't find it. And then if you say, oh, well, I did paper filing.
I worked at the local library or whatever.
Right.
It's not going to hold up. And realistically, your 1L summer job is really, really important. It's your first job towards your legal career, and it's where you're going to be getting your first real writing sample. You right now have taken like the ABA mandated lawyering class or whatever it is, where you write an objective memo and do you'll do appellate stuff in the spring. But you, all that's not real. It's based on made up stuff that is the same kind of generic, frankly, malarkey that everyone does in law school. And it's patently strange. Like anyone who has that kind of writing sample, when you're done with it, you're like, oh yeah, that was my writing sample from my lawyering class. Everyone knows that that's not real.
Right.
And so you really need to start developing your writing skills. You need to start developing your research skills. And you're going to be doing that through your 1L internship and externship. I think you're going to be behind your classmates if you don't spend those 3 months doing something like this. And you're also going to miss out on the meaningful opportunity to get real feedback on your writing and research and then develop a writing sample through that summer. I have a writing sample from that summer. I worked at the state's attorney's office in Anne Arundel County and did a whole bunch of research on criminal law and various things. I got to research a constitutional issue about asserting your marital privilege against testifying against your own spouse. That's a really kind of interesting issue to me. I thought it was kind of cool. It ended up being like an 8 to 9 page memo. I still use that writing sample. It helped me get my postgraduate clerkship. It was one of my 2 writing samples because it's a really interesting appellate issue, and I used it to apply to appellate clerkships. And so not only I think are you going to be behind on the educational value of what an internship is, I think you're going to be behind on your resume, and you're going to be behind on the things that go along with your resume when you're applying for future jobs.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. Plus, you need an experience where you are actually working with lawyers who are really doing whatever, you know, some sort of, like, for instance, working at Legal Aid. Every state has some sort of legal aid. It's probably called Legal Aid in your state, plus the state name. And you are actually seeing, like, okay, this client has, for instance, we had a client who was $20,000 behind on rent and didn't want to move. And what are we going to do? And this whole, like, what are you, you're, that's the kind of stuff you're missing out on. And this right. shouldn't, like, if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, oh my gosh, I haven't even applied to law school yet, and I need to start applying for internships after 1L year. You really don't. They're really not that hard to get. There are some that are like ultra yeah. prestigious and difficult to get. They're fine. But there are a lot out there. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't say, like, the one I did at Legal Aid, I wouldn't say that's particularly prestigious necessarily, but it's was very beneficial and was then something that has helped me a lot. So
yeah.
I don't want you to stress about it as you're listening. This is like the thing that should stress you the least, but both of us hear this email and we're like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, yeah. don't do that. Yeah. Partially because you can so easily get one of these jobs, but you have to do it right now. That's the other thing. We recorded this as soon as we could because you need to apply now so that the internships haven't all been filled.
Well, they can't apply yet because they don't have their 1L grades, but they need to start preparing for it. They need to, over the winter break, get their resume in order, get their writing sample in order, do those kind of things so that as soon as they get their 1L grades for their fall semester come January, they hit the ground running and apply to whatever makes sense. Now, to sort of transition, you could absolutely, there are people who go to work for firms in their 1L year and do make a little bit of money doing that. And it's a good experience and all those things. But there's a lot of other internships and externships out there other than just the law firm. Now, unless it's like literally like a single practitioner, or I should say solo practitioner, a law firm, if you go to work for a law firm, you're going to get paid. I have never heard of even a 1L law clerk not making some sort of honorarium. It's not going to be a ton. It might be like $5,000 or $6,000. And it certainly doesn't compare to like the $50,000 that you would make as a summer associate in your 2L year, certainly. But the 1L sort of situation there, if you work for a firm, unless it's really, really tiny, you are very likely to make something. But there's lots of jobs out there that also provide some sort of honorarium. You know, it might only be a couple $1,000s, but it's going to pay your bills. It's going to, like, your food and your rent. It will take care of those kind of things. It'll take care of your travel expenses. But that's not really what this is about. It is much more so about you becoming a better researcher and writer. To that end, though, you can do a lot of jobs for unpaid, like working for a judge. A lot of people go and intern, judicial intern during their summer for a judge. And as someone who did that during my 2L year, I worked for free my 2L year. That working for free, commuting to Annapolis on a bus an hour each way, was so incredibly formative. And I now have a clerkship at the Maryland Supreme Court for after I graduate because of it. Now, one other thing, I just can't highlight enough the idea of unpaid internships will lead to great experience doing real stuff that will help you get paid work. In the instance that you have an unpaid internship, apply for grants. You can get paid for your unpaid internship. At Maryland, for instance, we have the Maryland Public Interest Law Project, and you can apply for, like, if you're working for the government or you're working for an advocacy group or like that kind of thing, you can apply for a grant for like $3,000 to $6,000 that defrays the cost of working for free for this organization. Maryland is not unique in that respect. There are independent grants. There are grants through the school. There's public interest public interest grants through organizations like the state bar. There's a lot of opportunities out there that can help defray this working for free because they know not all the organizations that need help can actually pay you. And it's still really great, meaningful work.
Yeah. And I actually got one of those grants last summer. I got to work for Baltimore City Public Schools, which was perfect for me, like literally the most ideal internship given my interests and my goals after graduation. But they can't pay because it's the public school system. Duh. Surprise. Hello. And yet it was also, again, like this incredibly formative and beneficial internship. Right. but I applied for a grant with MPILP, or Maryland Public Interest Law Project. It took, I had to write a an essay about like what was I going to be doing. I had to get basically just verification from the employer that yes, we have hired her to come this summer. I don't know if it took me a full 3 hours to apply, probably total. And they ended up giving me a $6,000 grant, which, I mean, that is not crazy money. Yeah. But like also I used to be a public school teacher. So like, that's crazy money. And it works out to like 15 bucks an hour, which again, like I'm not telling you you're getting rich off of this, but like that is a very reasonable,
like, summer.
I mean, that's good. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Also, yeah. A great reason not to pay for law school. We'd be stupid if we didn't make that plug right there. We just have to say, FYI.
Yeah.
But yeah, the grants are out there, and there's so many different options. I would be very sad to see someone miss out on all the opportunities and all the benefit that can be out there, especially at the end of the email. Marisol said something about, you know, I would only do that if I ended up. I would only take an unpaid internship if it was a law firm I really wanted to work for long term. Like, you don't know that. That sounds so annoying for me to say that, but you really don't know where you want to work long term. And if you go into like, well, I'd really like to work at so-and-so and so-and-so, so I'll take an unpaid internship there. Well, they probably don't do that. Those are probably the most competitive ones at firms tend to be pretty difficult, you know, to get. And you might go, and by the way, totally apply, right? But you might go and hate it. Whereas if you go maybe that 1L year, it's nice to do like a more general subject matter. Like,
that's why a lot
obviously
of people work for
saying,
judges.
Exactly. And I keep saying legal aid for the exact same reason. Work for a judge, work for something like legal aid, work for, you know, volunteer lawyer services. Now, like, yes, you probably have a very good starting idea of what kind of law you might want to go into. So, for instance, knowing myself, I don't really want to do anything in the like appellate field, for instance. So, like, you and I had very different. We were never applying for the same jobs, which is great. Like, good for both of us. And it's much in the same way that you were not hoping to work at Baltimore City Public Schools this past summer.
Never but, in a million years.
But I loved it. I loved it so much. It was amazing. So if you think you already know, you're probably missing out on something. And if you don't say, okay, let me go make an appointment with my career development officer, there's no way you really know. And if your information is coming from your peers, there's super duper no way you really know.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to sort of just recap our advice to future 1Ls in vain of like Marisol's question. One, ask the CDO, get in there and speak with them, talk with them, see what is available out there. There's public career fairs. There's career fairs in general. OCI will have a bunch of different stuff depending on where you go.
What are all those acronyms you just said, Matt?
CDO, Career Development Officer. OCI is on-campus interviews, and then career fairs, regional areas. But just to reiterate again, we're in a post like world shutdown area of a human existence. Zoom is real. Becca and I are not in the same room right now. You can work exactly the same way as Becca and I are and do that stuff remotely. I have friends that worked in Baltimore for their remote jobs across the country, both summers, during the fall, during the spring. They did externships in Montana, in Colorado, et cetera. And so there are jobs out there. You just might have to think outside the box. You might have to look a little bit, speak to your career development officer about that. Paid internships certainly exist at the 1L summer. They are more competitive, that kind of thing. But unpaid internships don't necessarily mean they're unpaid. There's chances to get funding from elsewhere, including your school, including the state bar, including a variety of independent grant sources and all those kind of things. So definitely make sure to look for those and apply for them. It's not going to get you rich, but it will be an amazing experience. And if you don't do this, you are going to be behind and you are frankly going to pay the price for it.
I thought that was a wonderful recap.
Okay. Anything further to add?
It is, like I said, this is a wonderful reason not to pay for law school, because for both of us, as we've chosen our jobs, we've just thought, what do we want to do? What sounds most interesting? What's most beneficial to me? I don't really, if I can make more money, great, but I don't really have to stress about that. So that is just, there is never a day where that doesn't pay dividends.
Yep. Yeah. And this is a great example of when. So don't pay for law school.
We have an email here from Erica.
Yeah, it's a follow-up from Erica about the CUNY decision to offer only need-based aid, no merit-based aid.
Okay.
So a little more about that. Thank you so much, Erica, for sending this along. It says, I did call CUNY a few days ago, and I finally got a call back from someone in admissions who answered a few short questions. I found out that the reason why they stopped giving out merit-based scholarships is because they no longer have the funding due to the pandemic. Ben has twisted his head at an odd angle. Does that indicate skepticism?
I am skeptical, although there is an element of truth to this. State schools, when they lose funding for whatever reason, they have less money to throw around, and there is an actual cost per student, right, to educate them. And so then maybe it might be harder to give scholarships, but this idea that you can't give any seems a little odd.
Also, the pandemic is over, or at least we've decided that it's over and everything is back to normal now. So they're getting funding from, I mean, people pay tuition at the school. They have a budget. It's not like
it really depends. I mean, it comes down to this. It comes down to what is the cost of tuition? What is the price that they're charging for tuition? And what is the actual cost to these schools to educate a student? And the difference there, depending on how big it is, makes it easier or harder to give out scholarships, because really they're just discounts. You don't need to get money from anywhere to do it.
Yeah. And we find out now that CUNY is quite different. Here's one more claim. The person from admissions told me that their funding is allocated from donations.
Okay.
So they claim. I'm sure it is, at least in part. I would wonder whether it is in whole funding from donations. And maybe that's this, that they've decided, like, hey, you know, we're going to just make law school affordable, and that means we can't really give exorbitant merit-based aid. Anyway, yeah,
keep going. This is interesting.
Yeah. The person from admissions said they could bring back merit-based aid eventually, but as of right now, it will be need-based. Annual tuition for a full-time in-state student is $16,000 a year. Which then Erica says, it's very cheap.
I wouldn't say that's very cheap. We just saw on the other episode, on the Thinking LSAT podcast, that the in-state tuition for a South Carolina university was $9,000, $10,000. So 16 isn't very cheap, but it's closer probably to the cost. Well, right?
It's the most expensive, most expensive thing you're going to do during the year besides rent. Yep. Probably $16,000 a year is a lot. But it is compared to, you know, other law schools. Like, there's other law schools in New York City that charge $60,000.
Yeah. So in that light,
you know, four times that.
In that light, I don't know what it costs to educate one law student for a year, but let's guess $10,000. If it's $10,000, then this discussion is making a little more sense. If it's $15,000, it makes a lot of sense.
It's probably pretty close to that number at this kind of a school, right?
Yeah.
At Columbia, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the number is 30,000.
Because you're paying for all these high, yeah, salaried professors.
Big time salaries for faculty, right? And, you know, maybe their facilities also are, you know, more expensive to run, but, and they do, you know, better, like better brand of alcohol at their social functions for the students. Probably.
Okay. Sure.
So I could imagine it being a lot more, but it's going to also be a lot more profit when they, when someone pays them the $60,000 tuition. Anyway, Erica continues, if an applicant thinks they are eligible for a need-based scholarship, they will have to submit the following in their application addendum. A couple bullet points here. upload an addendum to your application explaining your need for financial assistance that addresses the following prompts. There are four prompts. Have you faced or are you facing economic hardship through the course of your life as a child and or as an adult?
Okay.
So you can get need-based money even if you currently don't have need potentially.
But you did as a child.
You did when you were a kid. Have you ever experienced housing insecurity throughout the course of your life as a child and or as an adult? So this could be 10 years, 20 years in your past, but it sounds like that's relevant to them. Have you experienced food insecurity through the course of your life as a child and or as an adult? Please describe what receiving a $24,000 scholarship, that's $8,000 a year for full-time students, $6,000 a year for part-time students, describe what that would mean to you. By the way, that's a scholarship of 50% more than the full-time in-state tuition. Please upload.
It's more than what?
It's 50% more than their tuition, annual tuition.
No, because it's 8,000 per year.
So oh, sorry. I'm dumb. Sorry. 8,000 per year. It's only half of the tuition. Okay. My bad. That makes more sense. Okay. So they're giving you half off of the tuition. You have to claim and show evidence of need.
Notice what they called it here, though. They didn't call it need-based aid. They called it a scholarship.
Need-based scholarship allocations.
Huh.
It could be only a shift in, it could be only a shift in like just nomenclature.
Well, here's why I think it might be. I do think these questions are suggesting goals by some people up top that they want to make the merit, the merit aid or the need-based aid, whatever you want to call it. They want to make the aid more tied to need than to merit. But given the number of questions here and how vague they are, right? Not, well, maybe it's not that they're vague, but given the number of questions, if they say yes or no to you or how much money they decide to give to you, you will have no way to pin that down to something. It makes it very easy for them to do whatever they want. So are they making a decision based on your need or are they making a decision based on your numbers? But they just have no need to tell you that because they've just acquired all this information. Also, people who don't think that they're going to get the need-based aid won't submit this information. And that's a tell as well. That's saying, hey, I'm willing to pay full price, regardless of what their numbers are.
Yeah. You know, we don't know that CUNY is like pulling semi shenanigans here, but we just know that other schools have definitely pulled shenanigans. With the distinction between merit-based aid and need-based aid.
It doesn't even have to be intentional shenanigans, though.
It could be accidental shenanigans.
Yeah. It could just be like, oh, okay, I feel good about giving this person more money. Oh, do you also notice that they have a 175? And is that swaying your decision, but you don't even realize it? The only way to make this 100% need-based is the admissions committee supplies these applicants to the financial aid committee with no information other than their financial need. But these questions right here seem to invite all sorts of information.
The other major bullet is please upload rent receipts and bank statements for you and your partner or spouse, if applicable, for the last 4 months. If you currently don't pay rent and do not have rent receipts, you can indicate in the addendum how you live on no income or who supports you. Erica says, these questions seem pretty thorough. They aren't just looking for a sob story because they're even requesting bank statements, which is a bit much to put into an application. If the applicant meets the criteria, then they will request additional documents like FAFSA. Final thoughts, Ben, on CUNY's apparently new need-based scholarship program?
Yeah, I do think that they are interested in helping people with need, but I also think there's a lot of flexibility here. And so who knows what will happen.
You should apply for it if you've applied to CUNY. I mean, even if you think that you're kind of a marginal applicant for it.
Absolutely.
You know, unless you think that would be like morally wrong. If you are comfortable enough that you would feel badly, then yeah, I'm not telling you to go ahead and apply for this. But if that hey, does 24,000 make a difference to you? Probably it does. And you can answer that question honestly. Answer all the questions honestly.
Yep.
And see what happens.
Yeah.
They are, I can definitely see that element to the program where it's like, well, at least we're going to make them ask for the money.
Today we have a big news item.
Yeah, I guess breaking news. The first thing that I heard was Yale Law School abandons U.S. news rankings, citing flawed methodology. That was in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Haley. Haley heard about it on Instagram, I guess, and forwarded it to us. But we have also an article from the New York Times, Ben, that you read and took a bunch of notes on about Yale backing out from U.S. news rankings. So they're just going to not, I guess, fill out the survey, essentially. Is that what that means?
I think so. Yep.
Okay. So then if they don't, apparently, if they don't fill out the survey, if they don't participate, then U.S. news can't rank them. So Yale Law, which has been number one since forever, is now, I guess, going to be unranked. We'll have to see what happens, because since then we have Harvard also has said that they're going to do the same thing.
Yep.
And Eric just sent in, producer Eric just sent in a Reddit thread that's claiming that Berkeley is also out.
Hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't know that they can't rank them, right? A lot of the data that they use is publicly disclosed in 509 reports and elsewhere. There's the common data set that all universities have to supply information to. So if I were U.S. News rankings and these schools said, hey, sorry, we're out, we're done, I'd be like, cool, have a good day. It's going to be harder for me to get some of the information that I want to rank you, but I'm still going to do that as long as there are incentives to do so. And I think there are strong incentives for anyone to rank these schools. So
what did Yale say when they made their decision? I mean, what's their evidence for their conclusion to not participate in the rankings? Which, by the way, I think Ben and I probably, we've said for a long time that the rankings are bullshit anyway. I mean, it's like a popularity contest in part anyway. And people pay way too much attention to rankings, especially on small slices. So we're not like mad at all about somebody getting, just saying U.S. News, hey, for, you know, we're out, thanks. But what was Yale's case?
Yeah, well, let me actually read Yale's response. This is from the New York Times article. When Yale was asked why, and specifically Yale's dean, Ms. Gerken, was asked why Yale is even worried about these rankings, given that they're number one, she said, it's not about Yale Law School. It's about legal education and the profession. It's a moment to step back and think about what we are doing. She continues, U.S. News rankings are a for-profit and commercial enterprise that is profoundly flawed. She said that the methodology does not give enough weight to programs like Yale's that support public interest careers, champion need-based aid, and welcome working-class students into the profession, and as a result, skews the rankings of law schools that emphasize that worked. Now, that, I mean, that's an interesting claim since they're number one. Maybe they feel like they're programs are being cramped, right? They would do them more, but for U.S. news rankings, they hold back.
Yeah. I mean, if they feel that they have been forced to make the decision, you know, the same admissions decisions that they're complaining about, because I guess go on into there's more to her case, right? Or at least the Harvard Law Dean makes a different case.
The Harvard Law Dean makes a difference case. The Yale Dean finishes by saying that 20% of the law school's overall ranking comes from grades and test scores. We've talked about that a lot. And she continues, this heavily weighted metric imposes tremendous pressure on schools to overlook promising students, especially those who cannot afford expensive test preparation courses. It also pushes schools to use financial aid to recruit high scoring students. That money, she said, could be diverted to scholarships for low-income students.
That's the game that we've been complaining about for forever, right? I mean, that's Absolutely. The game that we encourage our students and listeners to take advantage of and get themselves a scholarship to law school. But this seems to me, you know, if other schools followed suit, it could be, I think, exactly the the thing that needs to happen in this field.
Yeah, I was thinking about that on the way here. It's one of those situations, though, right, where everyone needs to, or at least a lot of people need to pull out of the system. Otherwise, the ones that remain will take advantage of the vacuum, maybe.
Maybe, but if Harvard and if Yale, let's say Yale, Harvard just become not ranked, or Yale and Harvard fall in the rankings as a result of not responding to their survey.
Sure.
I just got to think that it's going to be the credibility of the rankings that are going to suffer more than Harvard and Yale. And if this is true, that Berkeley has now jumped on board, now it can be like, and we're totally speculating now, but I wouldn't be surprised by this like race to be among the like, oh, well, we're just like Harvard and Yale, says yep. Berkeley. You
know? Yeah, yeah. We're like them. We're unrankable.
Right. And it seems to be this kind of thing where if we've said that, I think, for a long time, that this would need to start at the top. It can't start from the bottom. I mean, there are schools that don't participate, but those schools just get lumped in with like, oh, well, you're a shitty school. You're unranked. You're whatever. You know, people don't even think about you because you're not on the rankings. But that's not going to happen with Harvard and Yale.
Yeah.
And so if they, you know, if this turns out to be like a leadership moment for these schools where it does seem like it could change law school admissions pretty significantly.
Yeah.
And to the extent that you are going to be giving discounts, you can't keep playing this game of giving scholarships for to attract high to make yourself go up in the rankings. Like you just, if you keep doing that, then you are gonna be giving the money to the rich kids. I mean, you're gonna give money to the richer, whiter kids if that's your plan.
Well, that is not only what you are going to do, it is what is happening.
It's what you do now, in fact.
Yeah.
And it's gonna continue happening. Unless you follow suit here and decide that you're just not gonna give those kinds of scholarships in that way.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have any more commentary on this?
Yeah, I do want to read the Harvard Law Dean's argument about the debt metric. I wasn't. Were you aware of the debt metric as being a part of U.S. News rankings?
Well, I was aware that it was part of the ranking, but it's such a small part of the ranking that I was sort of also just, well, but we can ignore that because it's trivial.
So what is the debt metric exactly?
Well, so again, on this Reddit post, it seems to be a copy paste of a statement for public release at Berkeley Law.
Okay.
But okay. And then it's a commentator, a commenter who responds in bullets. But one of the bullets is the indebtedness measure in total accounts for 5% of the ranking.
Okay. I mean, that's still a decent chunk. It's a factor.
A factor, sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are what's the point of it, though? It feels like kind of a distraction, really, because what's the Harvard dean's case?
So Mr. Manning, that's the dean of Harvard, says the rankings methodology can create perverse incentives that influence schools' decisions in ways that undercut student choice and harm the interests of potential students. And
what?
Then the
what
example
are you talking
of?
Yeah. Right. Example. No, I'm out on that. What are you talking about? Okay, go.
So the debt metric adopted by U.S. News 2 years ago might appear to reflect lower debt at graduation because of generous financial aid.
It might.
So the debt metric looks at how much debt your students have when you graduate from law school.
Yep.
And if it's high, that's dinging you. And if it's low, then that's helping you.
High seems bad, right?
Yep. And it's like, okay, well, if it's low, maybe the school gave more financial aid. Ideally need-based aid, but it could be scholarships, of course, and almost certainly is. But he continues, but the metric could also mean that a law school admitted, quote, more students who have the resources to avoid borrowing. And to the extent that the debt metric creates an incentive for schools to admit better resourced students, in other words, rich kids, who don't need to borrow, it risks harming those it is trying to help. So it's trying to reduce the number of students who graduate with debt, but it might end up encouraging, schools to pick again.
Well, if that's what you're doing. If you're playing the U.S. News rankings game in your admissions decisions, then you're going to end up trying to go potentially for rich kids. By the way, you're already going for rich kids because of all the other metrics that that the U.S. News rankings uses.
Well, so even though it's only 5%, you have to consider it's another push on the lever, right? You're looking at an applicant and you're like, okay, great score. Looks like they got assets. Okay.
It's not nothing. Yeah. I mean, I think the broader argument, though, instead of being so specific about that debt metric, is just, maybe they're just not willing to admit, we want to stop making decisions based on what it's going to do to our ranking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by opting out, that's the clear signal that Yale and Harvard and apparently Berkeley. So far, this is Thursday, November 17th, by the way, that we're recording this. So there will be newer news and we'll report back to you if there is newer news. What's this down at the very bottom? What did Penn say?
Yeah, Penn said, it applauded Yale and Harvard for their leadership and said that it was evaluating this issue, but did not immediately offer to join in. Columbia and Chicago declined to comment. NYU said they were aware of the action by Harvard and Yale, but haven't made any determination on the matter yet. Sounds very lawyerly. So here's one takeaway from all of this, and that is, congratulations, Yale. Congratulations, Harvard. Thanks for showing your leadership, as Penn said. You're moving us in the right direction. You're moving away from this system that is creating these perverse incentives for admitting basically richer, whiter students who have more access. And maybe that's their motive. But could this just also be, I'm trying to think of less altruistic reasons for this.
There's lots of reasons.
They're losing money, right, in this no-win scholarship game. They just feel like they have to keep dishing out the cash to get these people.
I mean, Yale moved first. From Yale's perspective, they tap out as number one ranked law school for the last 20 years in a row or whatever. And they just then kind of become like untouchable.
Yeah, they win. They quit while they're ahead, right? Because Harvard just dropped.
How can they win anymore? Like being ranked one again next year doesn't help them.
Doesn't help them. Harvard just dropped, right? Harvard just dropped. And Yale mentioned, I don't think the ranking systems give enough weight to programs like Yale's. So is Yale worried about dropping to number two and therefore saying, hey, we're out? So if it drops, well, that's because we're out anyways. We quit before you even had a chance to hit us.
Yeah. It's a good way. I mean, I don't want to be devil's advocate on this one because I feel like it's pretty unequivocally good. You can have multiple motives for things, right? And so, sure, if some of them might have like a little other motives, that's okay. One of the motives here, I am willing to believe, is we don't like having to continue giving our scholarship money and our admissions seats to people to raise our U.S. News. Like, we're tired of declining all these people who are exactly 1 point below our LSAT median. And we're tired of admitting all these people who are exactly right on our LSAT median. And they don't want to make those decisions anymore. Now, of course, Yale and Harvard have the luxury of not quite making the decisions exactly that way. We'll see how many other schools follow, I guess.
So I agree that there are tons of problems, but I'm not going to say that it's unequivocally good because I think there are unintended consequences. And I don't think that I just don't trust these schools. I think that there's all sorts of motives and,
I'm certainly not saying that I trust the schools, but I just think that law school rankings are pretty much inherently bad.
Well, they're also incentivizing schools to do certain things that could be beneficial. like, think about it. The option to be regulated or unregulated. They're basically saying, hey, look, we don't want anyone looking over our shoulder. There can be a lot of good things that come from that, but there can also just be a lot of, well, you know, it's easier for us to do whatever we want without people noticing.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't have any faith in U.S. News as a fiduciary of anything. You know, I don't think that they're actually, I don't know. I think they're trying to sell rankings. I don't think that they're doing more than that. So,
well, I'm not saying that they're good either. I'm just saying we have a system in place. And when you change systems dramatically, you can have all the best intentions in the world, but then end up seeing the opposite outcome. And
yeah,
you see, oh shit. Like, I didn't think that was going to happen. And that's true for even a lot of these things probably that were implemented, right? For good reasons at first, but then even with this debt metric, maybe people thought, oh, okay, well, this is a good way to keep to rein in schools, but then maybe it flipped around, maybe not. I have no idea. But things can just cut in random ways, in unpredictable ways.
All right. Are we done with our wild speculations about what this all means?
Not entirely. What does that mean for the LSAT? Do you think schools will continue to weigh it as importantly as they have in the past?
I definitely think so, yeah. I think that they know from experience that LSAT is a good proxy for a lot of things. For the kids who are naturally great at it, it indicates that they are pretty strong readers, pretty strong with logic, you know, patient enough to sit there and solve questions.
Yeah.
For the people who work their asses off and then kill the LSAT, and we've seen people improve by 20, 25, 30 points these days on the LSAT. And for those kids, the 175 that they eventually achieve indicates that they have an unbelievable work ethic, which the law schools highly prize. So I just think that over the years, you know, they choose how heavily they weight the LSAT, right? And they weight the LSAT very heavily. LSAT in U.S. News rankings is only, it's like 10%, something like that.
Yeah, but it's also like correlated with other things. So a high LSAT score could mean you're bumping up other things as well.
But that's why they like it so much, right? It's like, well, if you kill that test, then you're probably got a few other notches on your belt elsewhere.
Yes, but do they care about those things because of the rankings, or do they care about them inherently, right? And if they care about them because of the rankings, then and those go away.
My guess is 50-50. Right. I mean, I remember Dean Z talking about that, saying, well, it's two things. It's your aptitude to succeed in my law school. And it's also what you're going to do to my rankings. Those are two separate things. And who knows what the weighting actually is. But I would be really surprised if they don't use. I mean, what else are they going to use? We got undergraduate GPA. But then what are you going to do? You're going to do a holistic evaluation of 10,000 applicants for 500 spots?
Well, this is where I wonder if like things like ability to pay become much more significant. So you're applying and you have a different range of applicant, but one applicant is better able to pay and you don't care about LSAT and GPA as much anymore because rankings don't exist.
So you use the FAFSA exactly backward. No, I think you have to do your admission decision before you can do the FAFSA. Or at least I would.
Well, it's not like merit aid is going away. I'm just saying, you're a school. These are for profit. They're not for profit, but they need money. I don't know. I think the LSAT. Don't get me wrong. You know, I think the LSAT is a great tool for keeping people out of the profession that shouldn't get into it, and assessing those who want to join it, but. There is this growing demand for it to be taken away as well.
Could happen. Yeah. We clearly don't know what's going to happen. We are excited to find out. You can email you can email daily at lsatdemon.com. If you have more news about this stuff, we will be reporting back. We wanted to just get this episode out as quickly as possible with this special news and our wild speculations on it. There will also be more on the Thinking LSAT podcast. That podcast only comes out once a week, so we'll have some time to think about it, and then we'll maybe respond more thoughtfully over there on that show.
Absolutely.
We've got an email here that came from our old pal Logan.
Okay, yeah. Hey, Ben and Nathan, former teacher Logan checking in with a quote from my criminal law textbook. Do we know where Logan went to school? I can't remember.
Harvard.
Okay, so this is a Harvard 1L sharing with us his lovely casebook reading. I remember getting asked how relevant the test was to law school all the time. Below is a good example. Hope everything is going well over there, exclamation point. So here we have a picture from his book. It looks like a criminal law book. This is oddly taking me back to law school where you're reading these cases from the early 1900s. But in any case, he highlighted this one passage, and it says, this has to do with criminal law. All that can be definitely gathered from the authorities is that to constitute a criminal attempt, the first step along the way of criminal intent is not necessarily sufficient, and the final step is not necessarily required. Okay, that's common law school reading for you. What is this trying to say here, do you think?
Okay, so this is a judge who is reading the authorities. Those authorities are citations from, and that's what had preceded in the chapter or in this opinion. This is really the conclusion of the argument. So the judge had gone through all of these previous court cases. Here's what they held. Here's what they held. Here's what they held. All I can definitely gather, the judge says, all that I can get from the authorities is that to constitute a criminal attempt. So in other words, I guess that's what we're arguing about here is there a criminal attempt?
Yes. Yep.
And apparently there are steps of criminal intent.
A criminal attempt, right? So to...
Oh, sorry. Criminal attempt, and then it shifts to intent. Sorry.
Yeah, so intent is an element of the attempt. Yep. Okay.
Got it. And okay, so the first step along the way of criminal intent is not necessarily sufficient. So what the judge is saying there necessarily means has to be. I mean, you've got to have it.
Yep.
And sufficient means enough. So the judge is saying that the judge is basically saying, I'm not sure that it's sufficient. Not necessarily sufficient.
It might be, but it's not necessarily, as far as I can tell. So the first step along the way of a criminal intent is not necessarily enough.
And the final step along the way of criminal intent, whatever that is.
Yep.
Is not necessarily required. So the judge is saying that the first step isn't sufficient and the second step, or it isn't necessarily sufficient. I guess it could be sufficient, but we're not sure.
We don't know.
The judge is saying, the judge is saying it's not automatic. It's not like the first step isn't you're not a shoe in on the first step. And on the final step, you might not even need it at all.
But it might be.
But so, it might be. It's not necessarily required. So there's a possibility that you don't need it, but it also could be required. I just don't know for sure that it's required. And the judge is essentially saying, I don't know shit. The first step, I don't think it's sufficient. The second, or I don't know if it's sufficient. The second step, I don't know if it's required.
Yeah.
It's a very uncertain holding.
Look at the next two sentences. Maybe it will.
The dividing line between preparation and attempt is to be found somewhere between these two extremes, semicolon. But as to the method by which it is to be determined, the authorities give no clear guidance. The line between preparation and attempt.
So when you start intending to do a crime and when you finally execute the crime or the final step, maybe the final step is maybe the final step is actually doing it is not necessarily required. I guess in some cases, maybe you can hold someone guilty for something that they didn't actually do if they got really close to doing it. Interesting. But we don't know. It's not necessarily required. Maybe it is required. The judge is like, all previous cases have told me shit.
Yeah, essentially that's what this is. It's just like, I can't really decide. The authorities are mixed. We just don't really know. Thank you, Logan, for forwarding this in. Appreciate you taking the time out of your busy studies.
Yeah. Yeah, we do see the words necessary and sufficient on the LSAT all the time. Not necessarily this convoluted, but that's the thing. Law school is just going one step further.
I mean, we could also like give easy definitions of sufficient necessary.
Yep.
I like your ticket to the party analogy. I think I got that from you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it costs $10 to go to the party.
Yep, exactly.
If I have $1 in my pocket, is that enough?
No.
So it's not sufficient.
Not good enough. Yep.
But do I have to have at least $1 in my pocket if I'm going to go to the party?
You do.
Because I can't have 10 if I don't have one.
Yep.
So it is necessary that I have $1 in my pocket. It's not enough. It's not sufficient, but it has to be true. It's necessary.
Yep.
Or else I can't go to the party. $100, on the other hand, is more than enough. It's clearly sufficient. I can go to the party if I want. But I don't have to have $100 to go to the party.
Yep. You only need 10.
So 100 would be sufficient. It's enough, but it's not necessary. I don't have to have that much.
Exactly.
And then the intersection of those two, it happens in this example at exactly $10. Exactly $10 is both sufficient and necessary, because it's sufficient because it's enough to get you in. And it's necessary because if you don't have 10, you're not going.
Yep.
11 would not be necessary. 10
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
9 would not be enough. It would not be sufficient. 10 is. But you can have assumptions that are both sufficient and necessary at the same time. I love that example. And that's really all we're actually talking about here.
That's it. And you know, it's funny because people will cross out the correct answer in sufficient assumption questions because they say, hey, this is way too strong. I didn't need $100. And it's like, yeah, but that's not what the question's asking. It's just asking for something.
$100 is enough.
Yep. And if it is, who cares if there's extra left in your pocket? It got you into the party. That's good enough. Let's jump into a logical reasoning question here. This is from Test 73, Section 4, Question 18.
So far this summer, there has been no rain in the valley, period.
Okay, seems pretty straightforward. Sounds dry, but I like that it's simple. I don't have to think, was there some rain? Was there a little bit of rain? No rain so far.
But usually a few inches of rain fall there each summer.
Okay, so this is not following the usual pattern. Usually we've seen some rain by now. Okay, where are we going with this?
Well, not necessarily.
Oh, it said usually a few inches of rain fall there each summer. Thanks. Mm-hmm. That rain could happen before or after the point of time in which we're at right now. So maybe we're following the usual pattern. Maybe this rain doesn't usually come until the end. I have no idea, but okay. Go. Got it. Sounds good. Thank you.
Since only 1 week of summer is left, comma.
I'm feeling what it's going to say next. Gonna say,
what do you think it's gonna say next?
It's gonna rain soon. It's gonna rain this week.
Okay, that's what they say. It will probably rain in the valley within the next week. What do you think of that? Oh, Ben is frowning, shaking his head.
Yeah, not necessarily. So we've had a summer with no rain so far, right? There's only 1 week left. If we were at the beginning of the summer and someone came up to me and said, "Hey, it's probably gonna rain sometime this summer," I would say, you're right, because it usually rains at some point during the summer. But this is a little bit of a different situation. We know that we've flipped a bunch of heads. That doesn't change the likelihood of the next flip. What's going to happen this week?
Yeah. How reasonable would it be if that was 1 day instead of 1 week?
Or 1 hour.
Or 1 second instead of 1 week. Like, it's guaranteed to dump right now because there's 5 minutes left in the summer. You can just see then how absurd it is to say, well, since there's only a week left, it's probably going to rain this week.
Yeah. The probability of things that have happened in the past don't affect the probability of things that are likely to happen next.
The flawed pattern of reasoning in the argument above is most similar to that in which one of the following arguments?
Okay, so I'm looking for something that kind of makes a similar mistake. They talk about the probability of something as a whole. We then learn about part of it, and then we make a conclusion about the probability of the last part of it or some part of it. It doesn't necessarily have to be the last part, I guess. But I suspect it will be because it has to do with time, maybe. We'll see.
I mean, it could be like, how about a baseball example? Clayton Kershaw usually gives up, gives up 2 runs per game.
Sure.
On average.
Yep.
But we're in the 9th inning now. So,
and he hasn't done it yet.
Clayton Kershaw is likely to give up those 2 runs in the 9th inning. You'd go, probably not.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Cool.
Yep.
Aisha has finished proofreading all but the last 2 pages of an issue of the journal Periodos and has encountered no errors.
I like this so far. It's very similar to No Rain so far.
However, there are sometimes a few errors in an issue of the journal.
Okay. It's not as strong of a claim to say that they usually see rain. They usually see errors. That's not saying that. It's just sometimes there are a few errors.
Yeah, usually means 50% or more. So sometimes now it's just not quite what we're looking for. Conclusion. So there may be errors in the pages that Aisha has not yet checked.
Well, this is interesting because I don't think this argument is invalid. But that's actually why it's wrong, right? It's such a weak conclusion. Sure, there may be errors. That could be said at any point, unless the evidence was that there's never, ever errors in these journals ever, and even will never be in the future. But yeah, so this argument's valid, and the original argument wasn't.
Looking at our data, that's the most commonly chosen wrong answer and I'm not surprised because it really does feel like, and I'm looking at my written explanation here too, it's like, I thought it was going to do it. But then at the last minute, the argument basically bails itself out by softening it all the way down to, well, there may be errors.
Yeah.
And then I can't really object. That's not probably there are errors. That's just there may be errors. Well, yeah, there may be.
If it had said there will probably be errors, I would still be pretty queasy here because the premise was about sometimes and it's just not.
Right. Yeah, there already was a difference, but now it's like a certain, like that's just, absolutely. It's conclusively wrong because the conclusion is just a much softer. It's just a different conclusion. B, there are generally few errors in an issue of the journal Periodos.
Okay. There's usually not many. Okay. It's like, I guess that's okay.
Kind of, but it's also kind of different, right? You'd probably
it is different. It's not saying that there generally are errors. Yeah, it's generally there aren't
there's
that
generally
many.
Few.
Yeah, I don't love it.
Which seems to be suggesting that there's maybe none. I don't know. It's different enough. And remember, we have to expect wrong answers to be wrong. So I think in real life, at real speed, you'd already be kind of turning up your nose there.
Oh, yeah.
It goes on and says, Aisha has finished proofreading all but the last 2 pages of an issue of this journal, but has encountered no errors. Hence, there are probably no errors in the pages that Aisha has not yet checked in this issue of the journal.
Well, that's going in the wrong direction anyways. So out. Okay.
Okay. Concluding that there aren't errors instead of concluding there probably are some.
Thank you. Yep.
See, on average, there are a few errors in an issue of the journal Periodos.
Okay, this is a little bit better, saying that there are errors, okay, on average, so usually.
Aisha has finished proofreading all but the last 2 pages of an issue of this journal, but has encountered no errors. You're nodding. Seems like you kind of like it. Can you anticipate what they would say next in order to be correct?
If it's going to be correct, you're going to do something very similar to the original, which said it will probably rain in the valley within the next week. So I expect this one to say there will probably be some errors in those remaining 2 pages.
It says, so there are probably errors in the pages she has not yet checked in this issue of the journal.
Gee, that sounds like the answer. I would just check the last 2 really quick.
D says, Aisha has proofread several issues of the journal Periodos and has encountered no errors.
Okay, so nothing so far.
Would you even read that further, honestly?
Well, it's talking about several issues. I don't have a, that's different, but I don't have a total problem with it because maybe the argument is just expanding the scope. Oh,
if it goes on and it says, but in a typical 52 issues, there are usually some errors. Yeah, I guess it could be right. You're right. Okay, so the next sentence says, but there are seldom any errors in an issue of this journal.
Okay, so then I'm not, there's no disconnect. There's no surprise, right? There's seldom any errors and we haven't seen any so far. I'm done. I already like C.
The gut.
Yeah.
At some point I'm shutting it down. You know, I'm like, well, wait a second. I don't need to read any more of that answer to know that it's wrong.
Yep.
You're saying there are, she hasn't found any and there usually aren't any. Well, you're not going to then go on and say whatever you say. It's just not going to be the same flaw. E, there usually are errors in each issue of the journal Periodos.
Okay, that's good so far. There's usually some rain.
I'm noticing the each, you know, saying, yeah, I guess each journal of the issue could be like each summer.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Since Aisha has finished proofreading the latest issue of this journal and has detected no errors, Aisha has probably made a mistake in her proofreading.
Yeah, this is way different. First of all, she finished proofreading that issue. And second of all, what? She made a mistake. Now we're blaming her as opposed to trying to figure out what's going to happen.
Well, the given argument would have to have said there's a hole in your rain gauge.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And it just didn't go that direction.
It actually did rain or something like that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You must have forgotten that it rained earlier this summer or something like that.
Yep.
Email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.